Our reading this morning is from Luke chapter 1, and we're starting to read at verse 68, which is on page 1027 in the Pew Bibles. This is Zechariah's song. Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, because he has come and has redeemed his people. He has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he said through his holy prophets of long ago, salvation from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show mercy to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath he swore to our father Abraham, to rescue us from the hand of our enemies and to enable us to serve him without fear, in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. And you, my child, will be called a prophet of the Most High, for you will go on before the Lord to prepare the way for him, to give his people the knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of their sins, because of the tender mercy of our God, by which the rising sun will come to us from heaven, to shine on those living in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the path of peace. This is God's word.
So last week, as we began our kind of Advent series, we were thinking about musicals and thinking about, remember we had that little quiz, identifying different musicals, and we were thinking, over the next 4 weeks, we're going to be looking at songs and how in a musical, songs unfold a story. They tell a plot line, and there's different characters who sing different things at different times to develop the story. Times there's going to be a whole production, the whole chorus of singing, major things that kind of bring an act to an end or start a new one, but they're kind of major things in the story. And the songs that we're looking at in the book of Luke, and this being the second of four, are very much the same. There's been a plot line throughout the Old Testament, an expectation, a promise that God made that he was going to do something to change our way of going. We're in the grip of sin with the fall in Genesis. There's a fall, but God is going to do something. And he unfolds that story throughout the Old Testament as the prophets speak into it, and we find more and more about what is going to happen. But suddenly, God does something. He arrives. He keeps his promise. He comes. Last week we looked at the Magnificat, Mary's song, about how God spoke into her life and said that she was going to be the bearer of the Son of the Most High, that she was going to deliver the Messiah, the one that they've been waiting for, she. And this wonderful song of praise, even though she had many reasons to be scared, she was young, she was unmarried, she was pregnant, she was poor, so many things that seemed to say, this is scary stuff, and yet her soul magnified the Lord. And this is the second one. We kind of move from Mary to a different part of the story. And here we have Elizabeth and Zechariah. Again, they're getting older and can't have children, and things are looking dim. And they've been praying for a child. And suddenly Zechariah, who's a priest, is in the temple burning the incense. And he has this encounter with an angel, with Gabriel. And Gabriel says to him, your prayer has been heard. You are going to have a child, a boy, and you will name him John. And Zechariah says, how can this be true? We're really past it. How can we know that this is going to happen? And it's almost like Gabriel has been a bit indignant, and he says, I am Gabriel. I have come from God. I'm telling you what will be. But because you didn't believe, you're not going to be able to speak for a while. And Zechariah couldn't speak. When he came out of the temple, there were people there, and they knew that he had some kind of encounter because he was trying to communicate as best he could without speaking, and they knew something had happened. And something had happened. And something did happen because they had a baby. And when that baby was born, the locals assumed that they would be called after his father, but Elizabeth said, no, he's going to be called John. And they said, John? There's nobody in your family called John. Why would you call him John? So they went to Zechariah, who couldn't speak, and they said, she wants to call him John. What do you say? And he asked for a piece of paper and a pen, and he wrote down, his name is John. And as soon as that happened, he could speak. And his first words were words of praise as he is filled by God's Spirit. And he breaks out into this wonderful song, a song of praise. As we thought last week, and as we thought the weeks before, as we were looking at the book of Philippians, praise is always the appropriate response to God. Worship, no matter what happens in our lives, the good, the bad, the indifferent, the ugly, whatever it might be, whatever challenges come along, praise is always an appropriate response. Because God is our God, wherever we are, whoever we are, whatever life is throwing at us, even through the darkest times, worship changes things. And so we find Zechariah praising God, verse 68. Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel. Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel. And what follows in the rest of the song is reasons to praise. Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, because he has come and has redeemed his people. Because he has come, some translation says, he has visited. He has visited his people. It's a lovely word, isn't it? He has visited his people. And what that is meant to be like, it's a bit like if you're ill at home and you can't get to the doctor and you phone the doctor and you say, I can't come. I'm really sick. Or my dad's really sick, or my wife's really sick. Can you please come? They're very ill. And you live somewhere desperately remote. But the doctor says, of course I will come. And he does a home visit. It's an act of compassion. It's an act of love. It's going to you because you cannot go to him. And that is what Jesus did. God had visited his people. Isn't that a beautiful way to look at it? And he has redeemed. But towards the end of Luke in chapter 19, Jesus is going to stand outside Jerusalem. He's going to use the same kind of phrase. He's going to be really sad because he knows what's going to become of these people because they had not recognized the time when God had visited them. They didn't know he had come or they had rejected him. And terrible things lay ahead for Jerusalem. It was going to be destroyed because they had not recognized the time of God's visitation. But the whole idea of redemption runs throughout Scripture, and the Exodus is the kind of prime example of redemption when God brought the people from Egypt, this great liberation, freeing from slavery, freeing from their enemies. But redemption always involves a price. It is always costly. And we're going to think about that in a little while. But redemption is always very expensive. But who will this Redeemer be? Verse 69. He's raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he said through his holy prophets long ago. So who's the Redeemer going to be? Well, he's going to come from the house of David, from that line of David. He would sit on that throne of David and he would sit there forever. But God had raised up a horn of salvation. That's a symbol of strength. If you think about an animal with a horn that's really strong, think of an animal with a rhinoceros or a bull, but it's a symbol of strength, and this is what God was doing. He's raised up this horn of salvation. It's strong, but he's raised him up, and that same little word or that same little phrase would reoccur at the end of the gospel when God would again raise him up from the dead. But here at the beginning, he has raised him up, this horn of salvation, from the line of David. So the psalm begins and ends with salvation. Verse 71. Salvation from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us. The salvation that the people were looking for at that time was largely political. They were under Roman occupation and they were looking for liberation from the Roman Empire. They wanted political freedom. They wanted religious freedom, they wanted economic freedom, they wanted all sorts of freedoms. And those are kind of tones that we recognize today, aren't they? There are people who are oppressed today who long to have all sorts of freedoms. And that's what the people were expecting back then largely. It was a political thing. But this kind of freedom was not the freedom that this Redeemer would necessarily bring, although in a way he did. In a way, he didn't. But who would do the preparation as the people needed to be prepared for this type of salvation? Verse 76. It's like Zechariah is looking at his newborn son in the cot. He says these beautiful words, "And you, my son." After praising God who would raise up this Redeemer, he looks at his baby and he says, "And you, my son, you will be called a prophet of the Most High. For you will go on before the Lord to prepare the way for him, to give the people the knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of their sins. And you, my son, will be called a prophet of the Most High." These were Zechariah's words about his own son. Zechariah was a priest, and he was familiar with the word of God, and he knew what the prophet Malachi had said, where he says in chapter 3, "Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me." And so when Gabriel spoke to Zechariah and the baby was born, he knew that this child was special. This child was the one that Malachi had prophesied about, the one who would go before the Redeemer, before the Messiah, who would prepare the way. It was his job to get the people ready. According to one Bible scholar, he says this, "It was necessary that John, the forerunner of Christ, should summon people to a realization of guilt and to a confession of sins, and should make as many of them as possible see that the real redemption needed by them was deliverance from the power of their spiritual enemies, sin and the forces of darkness, so that they might escape the wrath of God." People needed to know that the real enemy was sin that would lead to death. And I suppose for us today as well, if we think about our needs, if I were to ask you your needs, or to ask the people out there, what do you need? It would be all these things. I need my economy sorted out. I need more money in the bank. I need health. I need... But John comes along and tells these people, what you really need is forgiveness of sin. And that was his job, to tell them what they really needed, and the one who would come to really do that. And that's our job as well, isn't it? To tell the world that what they really need is Jesus, who is the way and the truth and the life. This is what we need, all of us, more than anything else. We can have all the money in the world, all the health in the world, everything. But if we haven't recognized our need for forgiveness of sin, then we are doomed. But this salvation is possible. Why? Well, verse 79. These beautiful words. "Because of the tender mercy of our God." How beautiful. "Because of the tender mercy of our God, by which the rising sun will come from heaven to shine on those living in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the path of peace." Isaiah had prophesied that the people walking in darkness would see a great light. Here was that light. Again, Malachi, at the very last chapter of that book, says that the sun would rise. "For you," it says in Malachi, "who revere my name, the sun of righteousness will rise with healing in its wings. And you will go out and leap like calves released from the stall." This is what forgiveness means. This is what it looks like. You're like a young calf who has been stuck in that stall. The door is open. They spring out. Because that's what it means. Sorry, Ross. Am I upsetting you? Oh, Ross, don't care. It's lovely to see you. You're looking so beautiful in your blue. But that's what forgiveness means. It is this release, this burden taken off you. Forgiveness of sins. Jesus, who comes with healing in his wings. This is an amazing story, an amazing reality. This Christmas message that we're thinking about can't be reduced to a sentimental tale. The world will try very much to make it so. And we can do that ourselves. It's a nice sentimental story. A baby and a stable. Some angels singing. But actually it's an act of war. A declaration of war. The promise that God made is here. Jesus has come to forgive sins. Our Redeemer is here. If we look to him, if we see the light shining on us, we will be like those calves released from the stall. We will leap with joy. But if we refuse to see it, we remain in our sin. And yet it's a declaration of war against sin and death and hell. Jesus has come to fix it. Jesus has visited us. The doctor has come. We're all sick and dying. But the doctor is here. Do we let him in? Healing in his wings, Jesus came to rescue us. Now, a rescue operation is of infinite cost. There was a man called, well, I've got a picture of him, Johann Westhauser. Maybe you know this story, maybe you don't. It happened a couple of years ago. He was a caver. He is a caver, a very highly experienced caver. And he discovered the deepest cave system called the Reisingen Complex. Don't pronounce that very well. In Germany. He discovered it in 1995. He was part of a team. And they went to explore it and to navigate it in 2002. But when he was in there, there was a rock fall. He was badly injured. Damaged his head, damaged his back. And for more than 14 days, more than 200 people battled around the clock to save him. He was trapped 3,200 feet underground. He lay in the icy darkness beneath the Bavarian Alps while doctors struggled to reach him and assess his condition. A team of 14 rescuers accompanied a doctor, carried him on a stretcher more than 3 miles underground. They crossed lakes by dinghy. This is all underground. It's amazing. They crossed lakes by dinghy, climbed 1,000 feet vertical shafts by rope, fought their way past underground waterfalls, and squeezed through tiny bottlenecks. At one point, they had to negotiate Mr. Westhauser's stretcher through a passage so narrow that an average-sized man has to double over and exhale in order to squeeze past. Along the way, they faced near-freezing temperatures and cave winds and a constant danger of flooding. The journey would take a professional caver more than 10 hours under ideal conditions. And they had to do all of this while carrying a man with a serious brain injury who needs to be kept lying flat as much as possible. He had suffered a traumatic head injury. He should be in an intensive care unit. Instead, he was strapped into a specialized stretcher, wrapped in a sleeping bag, under layers of styrofoam to keep him warm. One of the biggest dangers for a man with his injuries is cold, medics said, and the temperature in the cave was just 3 degrees centigrade. A doctor who traveled with the party carried a skull drill. So arduous was the journey ahead that different teams of rescuers worked in relay stages to bring the victim to the surface. Cave rescue is highly specialized, and teams converged across the Alps from Switzerland, Austria, and Italy to help. The task in keeping them supplied from above is equally demanding. So many rescuers and support staff have descended into the cave that the ropes they've used have worn out and must be replaced. The entrance to the cave lies more than 6,000 feet up in the Bavarian Alps and can usually only be reached by a grueling climb. A helicopter made 10 trips every day just to ferry supplies in. At first it had to. Anyway, it goes on and on and on. But they talked to the man who organized the rescue because the newspaper were asking, how much is this going to cost and who's paying for it? Does Johann Westhauser have insurance? But this is what the leader of the rescue, a man called Stefan Schneider, said. For us, salvation is at the forefront. How great. Salvation is at the forefront. We do not ask if someone is insured or not. We are committed to the rescue. When Jesus came to this earth, he was committed to the rescue. It would be costly, very costly. It would cost him his life. We're going to be remembering that in our time of communion shortly. Redemption is very expensive. It's not just a sentimental story, a nice little Christmas tale. It's of a God who loved the world so much that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shouldn't perish, but have everlasting life. The rescue is very costly. And it is true that if you had been the only person in this world, living on this earth, you, no one else, if you had been the only person on this earth, Jesus would have come for you, because he was committed to the rescue. It didn't matter the cost involved. It didn't matter the time taken. He loved you so much that he would have come on that first Christmas and give his life on that first Easter, because he loved you so much. And this is Zechariah's song of praise about salvation. Not just a nice song, but an amazing song of praise about an amazing reality of a God who loves us, who shines his light in the darkness. This is your God. This is your doctor. This is your king. This is the Son of the Most High, the Son of righteousness, who brings healing in his wings.